From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was 4 years ago now when the nature writer Terry Tempest Williams and her husband Brooke Williams were browsing in a bookstore in Maine when Terry came upon a small brown book on the shelves. And like you do, she began to absently thumb through it. Before long, she was caught by the unabashed exuberance of the language, and she wondered, who was this writer, and why did he write such a personal account about nature and its connection to a soul? The who part of the question was easy. Turns out it was Richard Jefferies, a British man who lived in the 19th century. The why part of the question, why he wrote the book, was harder to discern, and it would become for Terry, and even more so Brooke, an obsession to get this book called The Story of My Heart back into print. Well, they have now, and today in the program, they're joining us to talk about it after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. Become a sustaining member of KUER for as little as $5 a month. You can do that online at KUER.org. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So I'm not entirely sure about this, but the writer Terry Tempest Williams and her husband Brooke Williams seem like the type who take their time in a bookstore. Not looking for anything in particular most days, just wandering up and down the shelves, waiting for something to catch their eye. And 4 years ago, it happened. A book, for some reason, caught Terry's eye, a little brown book with gold embossing. And she was taken right away by the prose, ecstatic prose is how she described it, eloquent and florid and effusive prose. And she wondered, more or less, who was this guy? The title page said Richard Jefferies, 1883, England. Didn't ring any bells, but she kept reading. And in some ways, she really hasn't stopped reading the book along with Brooke. In fact, it became an obsession for these two. The book called The Story of My Heart and the writer, Richard Jefferies. Now, for Terry, it was about the beauty of the writing and the power of the ideas. For Brooke, it was that, but it became something else. His connection to it was deep, almost cosmic. Terry and Brooke became determined to get the book back into print, and now they have. They've reprinted Jefferies' book along with their own commentary, and today in the program they are joining us to talk about Richard Jefferies, his remarkable ideas about nature, but they're also their own powerful connection to him. The book, again, is called The Story of My Heart. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Terry Tempest Williams, you know who Terry Tempest Williams is, the Annie Clark Tanner Scholar, the Environmental Humanities Graduate Program at the University of Utah, the author of numerous books, which include Refuge and Red and many, many others. Terry Tempest Williams, welcome back to you. Thanks for being with us.
It's always so great to be at your desk.
Good.
Thank you, Doug.
Brooke Williams, written 4 books, including Half Lives and Escalante. They're both here, I should mention, for a discussion tonight about the book, and we'll give you the details about that as we go along. But Brooke Williams, welcome to you.
Thanks, Doug. I love being here.
Good. Well, okay, so I gave the basic sense of how this all began. So you weren't looking for anything in particular, right? You were just doing what you probably do a lot. It's a cool little bookstore on Main Street in Stonington, Maine.
Right. I think whenever you go into a small independent bookstore, a spiritual experience awaits you, right, whether the book falls on your toe or your elbow shoves one to the side. But in this case, this particular bookstore, it's sort of dark, it's sort of chaotic, yeah, and we always find amazing things there. And you're right, it was that little nondescript brown linen cover with gold embossed letters. And I started to read, and my eyes know no fidelity. They are not loyal. On the page, they'll leap out, they'll say done or continue.
Yeah. Do your job or I'm going to put you down.
Exactly.
Right.
And I couldn't stop reading. Hmm. And it was just one sentence after another. And I thought, who is this person? And I just fell in love with him. And Brooke said, are you ready to go? And I said, no, you won't believe this. Look. And Brooke started reading it, and there it began.
Yeah. Well, I want to have you read, if you would, that first little snatch of writing. I'm guessing this is the first part that really captured you.
It is. The story of my heart commences 17 years ago. In the glow of youth, there were times every now and then when I felt the necessity of a strong inspiration of soul thought. My heart was dusty, parched for want of the rain of deep feeling. My mind arid and dry, for there is a dust which settles on the heart as well as that which falls on a ledge. It is injurious to the mind as well as to the body to be always in one place and always surrounded by the same circumstances. A species of thick clothing slowly grows about the mind. The pores are choked. Little habits become a part of existence, and by degrees the mind is enclosed in a husk. When this began to form, I felt eager to escape from it, to throw off the heavy clothing, to drink deeply once more at the fresh foundations of life. An inspiration, a long deep breath of the pure air of thought, could alone give health to the heart.
So you read that and you're like, wow, what is this about?
I thought, this is beautiful. And I loved that notion, my mind arid and dry,
yeah.
For there is a dust which settles on the heart. It was lyrical. There was a depth of consciousness there.
Mm-hmm.
And it continued. I just kept reading it, and I kept waiting for my eyes to drop off, but they didn't. And I wanted to know who this man was who was obsessed with soul life. And I have to tell you, Doug, you know, in many ways, this is a love story. And there was a familiarity to the obsession of this author that was not unlike the obsession with the man that I live with.
Yeah. Well, that connection comes through for sure. And I want to spend some time with Brooke's particular obsession with this, which we will. But tell me about Goose Cove. You buy the book. You don't buy it right away.
It was too expensive. It was $75.
Right.
And Brooke just went, are you serious? We don't even know who this guy is. And what was interesting is I thought, okay, fair enough. And then I became even more obsessed with it. And we found out it wasn't in print. Mm-hmm. You know, there was, I think online it was $300-something if we talk economics. And then we thought, well, let's go back.
Yeah.
And that's when we saw that there was a sign, all prices are negotiable,
right.
And the woman sitting on the stool, you know, reading something else, said $25. And so we bought it, and then we went to Goose Cove, which is a gorgeous place on the main coast on Deer Isle. You walk, and in our case, I walk barefoot, and the forest opens up to the water with pink blocks of granite, a blue sea with seagulls, and Brooke and I just laid down on the pink granite, and my head was on his chest, and he read out loud, and we both fell in love with this wild mind, wild man who talks about how naked earth creates naked mind, and we experienced that.
Mm. Terry, you were particularly excited, obviously, about it. So, Brooke, what was the moment where it caught your eye, too? I mean, what was the thing that drew you in at first?
Well, that the price went to $25 was a big step. But then as we read it out loud, it just started to seep into me deeper and deeper. And, you know, we skipped around. We read the first chapter, and then we skipped around. And then, you know, it would take too long to just read there. It got dark. So we just kept reading, and at some point, I don't know where it was, but we said, the world needs this book again. We need to get it out again. And I think once I really started reading it carefully in terms of trying to make notes and to think about two questions. One is, why am I still reading this? Why do I care about this book that was written so long ago? What is it about it? And the second question was, does it have any validity today? Is there a reason to have this book out today? And I guess maybe the answer is the same for both of those questions. I don't know.
Well, it's so interesting, Terry. I mean, you talked about how Brooke was almost a little insufferable at, like, parties. But we would constantly talk about Richard Jefferies and constantly talk about this book. You say that the two were like a ventriloquist team.
It was terrifying. I mean, there were moments where I would just have hand signals like, you know, J with my fingers up, just like, no more RJ. And we literally, one night, I just set a table setting for Richard Jefferies. And, you know, maybe tonight when we're at Roland Hall, we should have a chair for Richard Jefferies. But no, seriously, you'd ask Brooke a question and he would answer with a quote from Richard Jefferies. That's how bad it got.
I'm a little better now. I've gotten over some of that. But
well, you were caught up in it. And it's interesting because, Terry, you talk about how he became, like, he didn't quite understand his obsession with it at first. And you say something changed at some point. When Brooke read Jefferies out loud, there came a point when you say it seemed like he wasn't just reading, he was reading it alive, that he embodied the words. Is that when you realized, boy, this has really got to him?
Well, I think, you know, there's something going on here that we haven't talked about. And you always bring this out of us. But the very title, The Story of My Heart, mm-hmm. I think the untold story is that, you know, Brooke was dealing with his own heart issues. And so I think in a way, this book is a call to aliveness. This book is about inhabiting the world with our eyes wide open. And Jefferies was dealing with a lot of health issues.
Yeah. Died at 38.
He died at 39. And so 39. He was very conscious of his own mortality. And I wonder, Brooke, you know, if that on some subtle level was guiding you. I mean, we didn't really put that in the book, and that's private, but we're friends. And I think that's an interesting question I would ask you.
You know, if it is, you know, it's totally unconscious, which I really believe is a serious factor. But I remember when we first started reading it and when we first thought that it might be something that needed to be reissued, you were teaching a class, and I remember at noon we all had lunch, and I went away. And I got some results on this heart test. I have genetic coronary artery disease, and I take drugs and watch what I eat and all that. But I came back, and we were checking in with the class, and I thought, wow, The Story of My Heart is the title of this book. But The Story of My Brooke's Heart is, you know, it's got a problem, and I got to deal with it. So there is a connection.
And I think that whole idea, you know, Jefferies is full of paradox because he writes out of embodied prose, but it's very much of the mind. Mm-hmm. But I think the full expression of his prose comes through his heart, with almost the heart chamber as the home of prayer. And I think, Brooke, you know, what I love about this obsession that we both have shared is I think it brought us both into the presence of our marriage, to the presence of wild minds, to the presence of really being rooted to a place and following those same paths over and over with new zeal.
Yeah. So I want to ask you about who Richard Jefferies was, who you learned he was. This was surprising. Rachel Carson was said to have two books by her bedside. One was Walden, makes sense. The other was this one.
I know, isn't that amazing? And I think it had to do with sight. You know, you read Jefferies. I mean, his book belongs on your bedstand. Yeah. He carries you into the dream life. Yeah. And you read a sentence or a paragraph, and I think it's an awakening. Every time I open his prose, it's an awakening. And when he talks about, I live to see, and I think, you know, I was telling one of my students, they were saying, what is this Richard Jefferies book? And I said, I think it's a stay against the zombie apocalypse. You know, I think he's the ultimate writer for steampunk, you know, Victorian life before the Industrial Revolution really took place. Yeah. And I think he's almost, I really view Richard Jefferies in terms of writer to writer. I think he has all the effusiveness and eroticism of Whitman. I think he has the stream of consciousness of Virginia Woolf. I think he has the physicality of Hemingway, although certainly not the lean prose. And I think he has that choiceless awareness of the moment of a writer like Krishnamurti. So he's deeply complicated. Mm-hmm. He doesn't believe in God, yet everything is infused with the spirit.
Yeah.
And he talks about the great indifference of nature, that there's no need for the supernatural because nature is truth and super-natural.
And that's enough.
And that is enough, more than enough. And I love that. And I think that for those of us who are searching for our own level of spirituality, he answers a lot of questions and is a consciousness that can hold two opposing ideas at once.
You know, it's interesting that he, this idea of your own spiritual backgrounds, I'll put it that way for both of you, because you write about this. Brooke, there's a sentence on that first page of the book, which you describe, Terry just read it, as this perfect combination of words. And it's this, it's an inspiration, a long, deep breath of pure air of thought. You write in the book, Brooke, that finding it was the latest marker along a path that you've been following for the last three decades. It was a path that diverged from the Mormon life that you had been born into. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that because, Terry, you also referenced that. You had your own roots in this culture. You mentioned yours as a genealogy of a people in a place rooted by a spiritual calling. So that part of it, the part of you rooted in Mormon culture, rooted in a place, did that resonate with you with what you were reading from Richard Jefferies?
You know, a little bit, but I think the real resonance with me was the fact that Richard Jefferies had very little formal education. He read the classics, and he was obviously a very smart person. But these ideas, this inspiration, these words came up through his feet from wandering around. There was no...
What do you mean? Came to him because he was wandering?
That there's this this thing that happens when you're out that we tend to gloss over nowadays. If we go out, we have a destination, or we want to climb something, or we want to see how fast we can go. But there's this step back where just being kind of open-minded and open on an open-ended journey, even if it's the same place over and over again. And I think that Jefferies came into my life at a point where, you know, my physical body was no longer able to do the more extreme, intense outdoor things that I had been doing. And I was sort of coming to this on my own anyway, but to have this support and the inspiration of his words, I think, really moved me further along my path. I was already well along it, but it was justification and it was exciting and it was just this kind of intellectual exercise again to how do we get this word out? Do we need it? Is Jefferies out there saying the world needs this now as much as it did when I wrote it, and you're the guy to spread that?
He writes, Jefferies writes, go higher than a god, deeper than a prayer, and open a new day. What does that mean to you?
It's interesting that you would pick that. It's my favorite quote. I just love that. The idea that in many ways it echoes Joseph Campbell, a god beyond a god. I think of my own grandmother, Mimi, who was a great mentor to us. You know, it's finding the truth beyond truth. And for me, Richard Jefferies, the power is that truth, that something beyond God, has to do with consciousness, that direct experience creates direct action, whether it's mind, body, or heart. So I think it's when he says, let divine beauty bring me to divine soul. I think it's again, how do we live with an attentiveness? How do you see it, Doug? I'm interested.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think that you say that it reads like a prayer, but he has a very different idea of a prayer in mind. And I guess this idea of, I mean, what Jefferies talks about is, this is how he puts it. He says, by prayer, I do not mean a request for anything preferred to a deity. I mean intense soul emotion and intense aspiration.
And I think it's that being in deep relationship. I love that. Higher than a God, deeper than a prayer. Deeper than a prayer, this is a man who knew suffering. This is a man who knew lament. And that you open a new day with both the aspiration as well as the rootedness of where we find ourselves. And there were two other quotes that I really love. One is this: the circle of ideas we possess is too limited to aid us.
I want to come back to that one.
Okay.
Because this idea
so powerful,
of new ideas,
right.
Well, it's interesting is in the context of what's going on today.
Exactly.
Climate change, for sure, global warming, but also the kind of dispute or the debate that's going on within the conservation community, which I think is interesting, and I'm wondering if there's anything in Jeffrey's there about that. We'll come back to it. But I want to have you read the second, on that first page, go back to that first page, if you would, and that pick it up from where you left off, because there's a story here, as we head into a break, I want you to talk about this. He talks about walking to a hill some 3 miles off, and when he reaches the top, he feels himself breathing new air. Because I want you to talk about this part, too. Do you want to say something about this or just read it first?
Let's just read it. There is a hill to which I used to resort at such periods. The labor of walking 3 miles to it, all the while gradually ascending, seemed to clear my blood of the heaviness accumulated at home. On a warm summer day, the slow, continued rise required continual effort, which carried away the sense of oppression. The familiar, everyday scene was soon out of sight. I came to other trees, meadows, and fields. I began to breathe a new air and to have a fresher aspiration. I restrained my soul till I reached the sward of the hill. Psyche, the soul that longed to be loose. I would write psyche always instead of soul to avoid meanings which have become attached to the word soul, but it is awkward to do so. Clumsy indeed are all words, the moment the wooden stage of commonplace life is left. I restrained psyche, my soul, till I reached and put my foot on the grass at the beginning of the green hill itself.
Now, Brooke, for you, that what he writes about psyche / soul, you found particularly interesting.
I did. Terry mentioned her grandmother, Catherine, Mimi, we called her. When she died, she left me all her books, and she was really a scholar. She loved Carl Jung. She loved Krishnamurti, Alan Watts. She read intensely, and a lot of her books are about Jung, and I really became sort of a closet Jungian because of her books and the fact that during the years that I knew her, whenever we were together, she would ask me about my dreams, and she would tell me what she thought they were. What the significance they had and the idea of the unconscious and the psyche. And Jung talks a lot about the psyche.
Yeah.
And the fact that Richard Jefferies talks about the psyche as the soul really started me thinking about this. And then I found a lot of research on this, and there are other people that said that had Jefferies lived during the time of Jung, that he would have been a Jungian too, which I think is so interesting. And then go back to what I was talking about before. This came from him wandering around and sitting with his back against trees in the middle of the day, watching the sun come down through the leaves. This is what happened to him. And this is what I think is potentially could happen to all of us and does on occasion when we let it.
Brooke Williams, he and Terry Tempest Williams are with us. They are talking about the book, The Story of My Heart by Richard Jefferies. Tonight at 7 o'clock, they're going to be discussing the book at the Roland Hall Upper School here in Salt Lake City, tickets to the event. You can get the details about that anywhere on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us if you like, if you have comments or questions, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. You ever heard of a man named Richard Jefferies? Well, neither had the nature writer Terry Tempest Williams or her husband Brooke when they stumbled upon an old book in a bookstore in Maine. They started reading. It was hard to stop. Jeffries, it turned out, was one of the founders of the British environmental movement. His exuberant writing began this obsession for Terry and Brooke to get Jeffries' writing back into print, and they have now. The book, The Story of My Heart, is back into print, along with their own contributions, reflections on it all. It's called, again, The Story of My Heart. They're going to be reading from it tonight at Roland Hall's Upper School. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. They're joining us now, Terry and Brooke, to talk about their reflections on the book. So I wanted to talk, you were sort of getting at this a little earlier, Brooke, about this idea of Jeffries thinking about idleness and leisure. All of these ideas came to him when he was just sort of walking around in his farm. What did he have to say about idleness? Because this was important to him.
He saw a lot of what we're seeing, except for now it's like 25 times or a million times more serious, that everyone is just so busy. Everyone's lives are taken up by all these details. There's a section here that, let me read it. Ideas like the importance of being idle. I hope succeeding generations will be able to be idle. I hope that 9/10 of their time will be leisure time, that they may enjoy their days and the earth and the beauty of this beautiful world, that they may rest by the sea and dream, that they may dance and sing and eat and drink. I will always work toward that end with all my heart. If employment they must have, and the restlessness of the mind will require it, they shall not work for bread, but for their souls. And I think about that because, you know, they say that our primitive ancestors would, you know, worked only hard enough to, it only took 3 or 4 hours a week even to have the food they needed to eat and all of that. And now our lives are so jammed, you don't know anyone who's not busy. There's not a bit of time to do anything, let alone this kind of soul work that we're talking about here. And I think one of the reasons that I'm so attracted to this is because, first of all, I like my idle time. But second of all, I think that's where the answers are going to come to us that we need, because certainly we don't have them now.
Yeah, what do you make of that? The idea of just, would you tell the story? I mean, he would walk the same path, basically, around the woods near his home?
Yes, and we actually
did that.
Shadowed him.
Yeah.
And I swear there were grooves of his feet. And it was a simple walk. It was not a spectacular walk. Mm. It was a wooded walk around a lake.
I think he had like 6 different walks,
oh,
according to my research, yes.
Brooke would know. I went on one of them and was satisfied. And I love that you can know the universal through the particular. And I think that speaks to so many of us that are tied to a particular place, and it draws us deeper to that place.
It's interesting. He was a free spirit. Jeffries was, ran away from home when he was fairly young, went off to sea, I guess, went to Paris.
He was clearly a dreamer.
Yeah.
You would have loved this, Doug. You know, when we went to his home that's now a museum, run by a woman more obsessed than we are. She talks about Richard in the present tense. And I said, I wonder if he had many relationships. And she goes, oh, he did. And he was very difficult.
You know, like so she knew.
She knew.
Yeah.
But there was this one, when you go up to the third floor, there's a young Richard Jeffries who was dreaming of escaping, you know, going out to sea. And I kept thinking it was Joseph Smith.
Wow.
Because he had those little knickers and the white shirt, you know. But I think, you know, our own ancestors are from Britain, so I think that was also compelling for us. And speaking of kin, I have to say that this book would not have been republished. No one would have appreciated the obsession, or for that matter, Richard Jeffries' florid prose, had it not been our own relatives. You know, Mark Bailey and Kirsten, they at Torrey House Press said, we love this idea, let's do it. You know, there was nothing in it for them except for debt. And so I think it isn't just Richard Jeffries' obsession that beget our obsession, but I would also say that, you know, Mark and Kirsten have also shared this obsession enough to publish it. So that has to also, I think, be called forward.
What does it mean to you? I mean, you wandered around his the grounds of his where he lived. So he did go off to Paris. He did go off to the sea, but he did come home.
And then you have these thoughts. I love this passage. Why this clod of earth I hold in my hand? Why this water which drops sparkling from my fingers dipped in the brook? When? Why? What for? When is enough? You know, he asks these questions that I think, again and again, what does it mean to be human? And that was his cause. You know, and if I keep my eyes open, if I don't avert my gaze, if I do learn the truth of nature through the soles of my feet, then where might I go as a human?
When is enough enough was that seemed like a resonant theme for him. And that seems entirely relevant today, don't you think? I mean, we're talking about, you know, especially when you're thinking about questions of sustainability, questions of materialism, those kinds of things. Seems like that's a question he asked all the time. At what point is it enough, folks? Don't you think?
I think it's fascinating that this was all happening right in the sort of beginnings of the Industrial Revolution when, you know, we started using, you know, coal to power our lives, and he had a sense that, you know, that might be a problem at some point. I think that's another thing that really attracted me to it, is just that how he was prophetic in so many different ways.
And he was saying that there was enough food that one could grow in 1 year.
Yeah.
That why is there poverty? And poverty was something he knew very well. And, you know, there were many times where I thought he sounded like a British Wendell Berry. And I think it's also important, and we didn't focus on this, but there's another book that's just been republished by Penguin on his writings about sustainability, farming, food. He was a great activist on behalf of the laborer. And you see that over and over. I love that quote, "The wheat is beautiful, but the human life is labor." He understood the difficulties and also the virtue of work. And that's another theme that I think comes through the story of my heart, that we are nothing without work. And there again lies another paradox, the need for idleness, but also the gift of work.
That was it's not a contrasting idea, but he also, it wasn't just about not doing anything, as you say. And chapter 2 of the book, which, by the way, the context, and we should explain, which as you sort of have, he was suffering from tuberculosis, which was, of course, the disease that would kill him, as you said, 39. But Brooke, would you talk about how Jeffrey saw the human body? Because he saw the human body as you put it, the zenith, nature at its zenith. And his standard of perfection were the men of Sparta.
Yes, I know. I love that chapter because I've always felt like there is a ideal human body. And how do we attain that? And what would we look like? And so on. And I think that by doing things that the human body was built to do. And I felt like Richard and I had an affinity about that because he felt the same way. And in my writing about this chapter, the people of Sparta, and he was really taken by the Greek statues.
Yeah.
And there's another paper that was written by him called The Nature in the Louvre. And Terry and I, to get to England, we went to Paris because the nonstop cheap flight, and then we were going to take the Channel to England. So we decided to go into the Louvre. And I said on the way, I said, we'll use Richard's guide to the Louvre, this nature guide. And it turns out it's about one statue with no head and no arms. And he goes on and on about that and how that statue was better than all the rest because it did show kind of the curves and the wrinkles and the grooves. And it just made me think back to the days where I was really interested in what the human body is really supposed to look like and what it's built to do.
Well, he called it a sacred duty to be exercising or to be physical exertion. That was a sacred duty, he said.
And I also felt that the body, the earth, the body of the earth, again, no separation. He saw both as its own complete truth, one to be explored, one to be revered, one to love.
It's interesting, this idea of how would he fit today in the context of beautifully sculpted bodies? You see them everywhere. You even write about this, that you know you can get it in a gym, or you can get it on a farm, mm-hmm. or you know doing. I mean, how do you see? Because that's his writing about that seems pretty relevant today, which seems weird that it would be so right on.
Yeah, like, and you wonder. There's nothing that I saw that he would look at around him and say, we're really losing something, and by looking at the people around him, for instance. But like we can now, I mean, every time we open the newspaper or a magazine, we read about how we are obese and, you know, that all of that.
I can't imagine, though, Richard Jefferies on a treadmill.
No.
I mean, just that very notion would defy his sense of spontaneity. Oh, yeah. And that walking on a treadmill, one could say, well, he had his own treadmill of walking the same path over and over and over again. But I think, again, he talks so much about, here's another paradox, interiority, his soul life, but it was absolutely directly tied to the outside.
Oh, yeah.
And I think so much of our physical fitness is derived from inside.
Exactly. And it's taken an element away from it. I think he was really tapped into where our survival came from as people out walking in the landscape. And I think that I don't think he really said, this is what I'm doing, but that's what happened to him. That's where his philosophy came from.
You know, one of the most powerful things for me, and I don't know how you would feel about this, Brooke, but we went and saw one of the white chalked horses.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, actually. Tell about that. Tell what it is first. I'm sure people are aware of it.
Well, the horse, the white chalked horse of Huffington, it is so beautiful. And we thought, surely if this was close to his home, to his walking paths, he must have seen this. Yeah. He must have thought about it. He must have pondered it. And in fact, he did. And we found this quote of his that was in one of his articles, one of his 500
essays. Explain what it is first, because it's this, for those who don't know what it is, it's this.
It's enormous.
Centuries, millennia old, this thing.
It's located in the Bronze Age from 1000 to 700 BC.
Yeah.
It's absolutely immense. You only can see it from the air or from afar. You can never see it when you're standing there. Yeah. You can never see it. The way in which you see the white chalk Huffington horse is through your feet.
Yeah.
And he said this. This sculptured white horse is of a gigantic size and is represented at full gallop. It may be seen 14 or 15 miles off, it being formed by cutting away the turf down to the white chalk. Immediately beneath the figure of the horse is a conical mound or barrow, known as the Dragon's Mound, from a tradition that here St. George slew the dragon, whose blood was of so poisonous a nature that nothing has since grown upon its summit, which is bare, exposing the chalk. And I felt that, you know, as we were walking the white outline of this immense horse from the Bronze Age, it reminded me of how one walks one's life. You know, you can't see it from a distance. You don't have that perspective except for maybe death. And I feel like that it's the same way with Jefferies' prose. You can't see it as a whole. You just keep reading word for word for word. And his prose mirror his walks. And it is in the dutiful walking through his prose that you see the particularity that gives birth to the cosmic, if you will. Mm-hmm. And I think that that white horse embodied that.
Terry Tempest Williams is with us. She and her husband, Brooke, are here talking about the book, The Story of My Heart by Richard Jefferies. Tonight at 7 o'clock, they're going to be discussing the book at Roland Hall Upper School in Salt Lake City. We have details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Terry Tempest Williams and Brooke Williams. We're talking about The Story of My Heart by Richard Jefferies. They're going to be reading from it tonight. We'll give you the details about that as we go along. They're joining us now to talk about it. So we were talking earlier about this circle of ideas. It was something that that Jefferies says a lot, that he wants to create a new idea or a new story almost And as I said earlier, it kind of made me think about this current debate going on within the conservation community, which we talked a little bit about when we were in Montana and you joined us there. This call from Jeffries to get away from the confines of tradition, create a new book, as he said, new thoughts for nature. Does that fit in today? Does that help resolve? Not that there's a massive dispute going on, but people are wondering the way forward. What do you make of that?
That's really interesting, Doug. You know, just now there's a letter in the periodical Nature. Two women, one from the Nature Conservancy, one from Stanford, calling for a rapprochement. You know, let's quit bickering from the old conservationists and the new conservationists. The wild versus, you know, a biocentric view of wilderness versus a more technological perspective, that there is no more wilderness. And I think they've now come up with new language that those who view nature and wildness as intrinsic and those who view it as instrumental, one that's more nature for its own being versus nature as a tool of man. Where would Jeffries fit in? That's a really interesting.
I don't think there's any question.
You think he would say that it's...
that it's its own
intrinsic
being. Yeah, totally intrinsic.
Because he didn't think much of man, actually, and he certainly didn't believe in God.
He didn't think much of modern man because how many times in this book has he said something about there needs to be, like you mentioned earlier, another idea? How do we come up with this new idea? We've had the same ideas for 12,000 years since the caveman, he said.
And I love when, to finish that idea, the circle of ideas we possess is too limited to aid us. We need ideas as far outside our circle as are outside those that were pondered by Julius Caesar. I love that. And Brooke, one of the pieces that you wrote, which is my absolute favorite, and I really came to a deeper understanding of Jeffries because of you, because of this passage. And it came hard-earned. And I think it's indicative of, again, why the obsession with you and Richard Jeffries stands. Would you share that, the part where you're on the train?
Sure. It's kind of long, but let me see if I can cut it down here.
We'll talk about it first.
Okay. Well, I just had this. I was sitting out on a really beautiful winter day in Castle Valley, and all of a sudden I was thinking about that I was on this train, and the train was the perfect train. It was the modern train. It had, you know, it was solar powered. All the great progressive people were there with me on the train.
Right.
And we were just cruising along. But there was something in my mind that said, this train is not going in the right place. And all of a sudden, in my mind, Jeffries spoke to me through my headphones. And he said, get off the train. Get off the train. And I just have been thinking about that ever since, because here we are, if we're good progressive people, we recycle our garbage and we drive a Prius and we're doing all these things, but yet that we're still kind of going in the wrong direction and some big, deep systemic changes need to happen.
It's interesting. There's this section where you write about how, Brooke, how Jeffries speaks directly to you in the sense that there, you even put it this way, it seems like from time to time, there's no membrane that separates you. And so you have there's this particular chapter where you write him a letter and you conduct an interview with him. How did that work exactly? It's interesting because some of the questions you ask him. Here's one, for example. You say, what are we to do about climate change? So here you are, Brooke Williams asking Richard Jeffries what we're to do about climate change. What does he tell you?
He says...
I'll put aside how you got an answer, but you're imagining what he's going to say to you. What is he telling you?
He's telling me that... Well, and I pull his right out of his work.
Yeah.
I make up the question myself, but... And I also felt like by this time, I really want to... just be kind of more be creative about how I'm writing about all this. And this just happened, and then I wrote it down. I thought, you know, that kind of works. If they don't like it, they can change it. But Jeffries says, I'm convinced that much more can be done, that the length of time may be almost measurably shortened, that there must be much more. There must be things which are at present unknown by whose aid advance may be made. Research proceeds upon the same old lines and runs in the ancient grooves. And that kind of led me to the idea of ancient grooves, train tracks, and then I like imagined being on this train, this really great train. But back to the circle of ideas and the ancient grooves, his whole point is that the biggest problem that we have is we think this is all there is, yeah. that these ideas are we've run out of ideas and we have to make the best use of them. And his we gotta there's more. There's something out there.
See, Terry, I can't tell if Jeffries is hopeful or hopeless about what's to come. Because he says this. Brooke, you write, Jeffries has no hope for the masses. He writes this, so grown to its chains, to leave them is the only resource, to leave them. So is that hopeful or hopeless? What did you get from that? Because as you say, he didn't seem to think a lot of humankind sometimes.
To me, it seemed beside the point.
Huh.
And that's why I loved him, because I think when you really read this book, he's talking about presence. To be present in the moment at hand, to be conscious, to walk with your eyes wide open, and to take care of one's soul life. And in a sense, that is the story of his heart, soul life. And I love that question when he says, what can you affect by the soul? And what I get from Richard Jeffries is that we can only go so far with the mind. We can only go so far with our own understanding, that in the end, it's about love. In the end, it's about our relationships to the world around us. And when he asks, what is enough, that becomes more than enough.
He was a harsh critic of complacency. The listless mind didn't care for that at all. So I wonder, how has this changed your own approach to nature, the way you live your lives? Coming to know Richard Jeffries, coming to know his intolerance complacency.
What a great question. He's changed my writing.
Really?
Yes. And I realized in reading Jeffries how controlled I've been. Hmm. You know, how careful I've been.
Because he was so exuberant.
He was so exuberant. And I thought, what would it be like to really just write out of one's heart? You know, not think, will this offend? Or how do I find a language that opens hearts rather than closes them? You know, but to just fully write out of one's being, fearless, that I don't care if people say this is florid or this is exuberant or ecstatic. And that's how I think Richard Jeffries has inoculated me against my cynicism, you know, my carefulness. I think he's just made me want to be in love with the world and be in love on the page, and regardless if people think I've gone over the edge, because at what peril? So that's how he's changed. And I think he's introduced me to Brooke in a way I would never have known.
Yeah. Well, that's an important part of the story. We didn't get a lot of time to talk about, but that's the love part of the story too, is your relationship, how it transforms.
So I think it's, you know, the story of my heart, the story of Jeffrey's heart, the stories of Brooke's heart. It's how do we be present with one another in our full passion, on the page and in the world, unabashedly.
What about you?
A lot of that. I love the part where he talks about the mind is capable of anything. So it's not like we're limited by our mind. And he talks about it's as if we're looking out a window and all we see with our mind is what's directly out the window. And we don't realize how much more is out there. And that's our limit. So for me, it's changed me because I know that I have a window that I look through. And I just have now decided that I need a much bigger window, or at least to tear down the wall or something. Just to find out what's out there besides.
You know, it's interesting. I mentioned earlier, so Jeffries runs away from home, has these adventures, but he spends the rest of his life when he gets back roaming close to his farm. So what are you thinking about home now? You know, you have different homes, you have different places, you feel connected to all of them, I guess, but do you feel like at some point you're going to return to someplace? and wear out that familiar trail, you know, a familiar path.
My cousin Lynn, just yesterday, you know, we both challenged each other. We're both at different points in our lives, and we challenged each other to write a paragraph about what do we want. Because I think as women, we're giving, giving, giving. And mine was really simple. It was one sentence. I want to come back to Utah. You know, everything is here. Everything. You know, and you and I, we talked about Salgado. And he returned back to Brazil to restore his forest. And I thought, I want to come back home in the fullest, deepest sense and root our soul life. That's where I live. That's where I want to be.
I feel the same way, but I also feel like Jeffries has reinforced this idea in me that I've touched on and I've felt a little bit, but I haven't been able to fully explain, and that is if you are in a place surrounded by an intact working natural system, something happens to you and it doesn't matter where it is. So I feel like for me, home, I feel like a turtle. I feel like I carry it with me, and I'm able to just be a part of a place just by being actively moving in it, by understanding it a little bit. But home is in southern Utah, and I'm really feeling that the next phase of our life is to really get much more involved in that place and saving it and working it, loving it, and sharing it.
That's writer Brooke Williams. He and his wife, Terry Tempest Williams, are here talking about The Story of My Heart by Richard Jefferies. Tonight at 7 o'clock, they're going to be discussing the book at the Roland Hall Upper School in Salt Lake City. We have details about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Terry and Brooke, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's so great to share this home.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.